Good afternoon, and thank you, Leonard, for the kind introduction. It's an honor to be here with you all. I will try to speak slowly and clearly so that you can all hear me at the back, but this PA system looks to be pretty good. So thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here. I'm feeling a bit naked because they expressly asked me not to have PowerPoint slides, and because we're completely dependent on PowerPoint, so I'll have to rely on my higher PowerPoint today. In the true tradition of AA, so. I'm always coming up with these puns. Excuse me. My goal here is going to speak. I'm going to speak for about 20 minutes, and then we'll have some Q&A, and then Dr. Maria Pagano is going to speak for about 20 minutes again, have some Q&A, and then I think we're going to have about a half hour for general discussion, which will be good as well. I'm here as a research scientist. I work at Harvard Medical School in Massachusetts General Hospital. I've been in the field for about 20 years researching treatment, helping to hopefully improve treatment, understand the mechanisms of treatment, as well as recovery support and peer support services like Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've done a lot of research in this area looking at the effectiveness of Alcoholics Anonymous as a peer support entity that can support people's recovery attempts over time, as well as treatments designed to link individuals with AA and groups like AA in the community to support recovery over time. And in terms of the growth and influence of Alcoholics Anonymous in particular, there's one quote that I have learned off by heart, which comes from the Alcoholics Anonymous literature from the second tradition in the 12 and 12. And in this particular instance, Charles Townes, who was the administrator of a hospital in New York City, was speaking to Bill Wilson. And he says to Bill Wilson, he says, "When my head doctor, Dr. Silkworth, told me of the idea of helping drunks by spirituality, I thought it was crackpot stuff. But I've changed my mind." He said, "One day, this bunch of ex-drunks of yours is going to fill Madison Square Garden." Now, that was in 1937. And his prediction was, boy, you know, you guys are good. He saw something which was that made him change his mind. And if you're here new or as a visitor and you see 61,000 people in recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous at this convention, that's something I think would change people's mind about the power of people, the power of peer support. That kind of skepticism actually has existed all along and still exists today, ironically, even though we've had a lot of very rigorous science conducted on AA and treatments designed to link people with AA, particularly in the last 25 years. So I'm going to kind of tell you in 15 minutes or less kind of what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now with regards to the scientific story of alcoholics, alcoholism treatment and AA. Prior to 1990, The research base on Alcoholics Anonymous was viewed as pretty poor. We didn't really have good measures, good psychometrically validated measures of AA participation. And the studies that had been done up until that time were really not very serious. It wasn't really considered to be serious science. They were generally correlational studies looking at the same time point, so you couldn't really determine cause and effect. You know, was it because people had a better prognosis and therefore they went to AA and really they would have done just as well without going to AA? Or was there really a causal effect of AA? So these questions were up in the air. Now, in 1990, the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences, that's a very highfalutin body out there, said, look, we need to publish a volume on broadening the base of treatment for alcohol problems. And that's what they did. In that volume, they stated that they said that we've got this huge problem with alcohol in the United States, and we have this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. There's about 1 million people going to AA. It's highly influential. Most treatment programs employ its principles and practices in treatment and are referring patients to it, but we know hardly anything about it. So what they called for in that big tome of a volume was more research on Alcoholics Anonymous and on its mechanisms. Okay, this was published in 1990. Now what that did, because it was coming from the Institute of Medicine, of the National Academy of Sciences, it really got people's attention. So that call for research really legitimized serious scientific investigation into AA and its mechanisms. And in the last 25 years, there's been a ton of rigorous research that's been done on AA and its mechanisms. Shortly after that, there was a convention convened in New Mexico to really kind of set the stage for this next phase of research, because the National Institutes of Health and the Department of Veterans Affairs were ready with money to put money behind research that could actually unravel the mechanisms and look at the efficacy and effectiveness of AA and related treatments. And Bill Miller and Barbara McCrady. Bill Miller was some of you may know, he kind of invented a particular treatment called motivational interviewing. He became very famous for that. Barbara McCrady was a researcher at Rutgers, and they convened this big conference in New Mexico to bring together all the best minds at the time on alcohol research, and included anybody who'd done research on AA. And out of that came a monograph which was published by Rutgers University Press called Research on Alcoholics Anonymous. It was published in 1993, and that really set the stage for the next 20 years of research. So what have we learned since then? We've learned a lot. I would say in the last 25 years, we've learned more in this period of time than we knew in all the years prior to that, in the 80 years that AA has existed. There began to be serious attempts to look at cause and effect and randomized controlled trials. The biggest and one of the most famous was a study that was funded by the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism called Project Match. And Project Match was the largest psychotherapy trial ever conducted. It consisted of 1,726 alcohol-dependent patients. And they were randomly assigned to one of three different treatments. One was cognitive behavioral therapy, which had a lot of empirical support and was grounded in cognitive and behavioral theory. Behavioral theory and social cognitive learning theory, these very robust learning theories. So theoretically very well grounded. There was another therapy to which patients were assigned called motivational enhancement therapy, which was based on the principles of motivational interviewing that I mentioned earlier that Bill Miller had started back in 1991, published a book of that title. And there was another treatment called 12-step facilitation. And this was kind of an indirect way, because it's difficult to study AA itself, this was an indirect way to try and get at a kind of a causal effect of AA participation on outcomes, and would there be an effect? Okay, so these 1,726 patients at nine different sites around the country were randomly assigned to one of these three different individually delivered psychosocial treatments for alcohol dependence, and they were followed up at 1 year and then 3 years later. And what they found was surprising to a lot of people, okay, in part because most people thought that the clear winner of this trial was going to be cognitive behavioral therapy. Because it was well-grounded, been empirically supported, been lots of studies supporting its efficacy. So that was kind of like the Ferrari of the race. People thought also that motivational enhancement therapy would probably come in second because, again, that was very well-grounded in theory. That was kind of like that was a shorter treatment. That's kind of more like a Prius. That was going to get there, but perhaps not as fast. And then the 12-step facilitation in many people's minds was kind of like the Beverly Hills Hillbillies wagon, you know, with that was going to come in clear last, and clearly be the final nail in the 12-step coffin, proving once and for all that AA, at best, did no harm, and at worst, was actually harmful. So what surprised a lot of people was actually that the 12-step facilitation condition did the best out of those treatments. Where there were differences, it actually tended to favor 12-step facilitation, and this surprised a lot of people, including the people who designed the trial, because they certainly did not expect it. One of the things that was particularly noteworthy was that the ability of 12-step facilitation treatment to produce much higher rates of full sustained remission. So when they compared patients in the first year after treatment who were completely abstinent for that entire year after treatment, there were 15% in CBT who were continuously abstinent, patients assigned to CBT, 14% in MET, which is the motivational enhancement, and 24% in 12-step facilitation who were continuously abstinent. In other words, that 9% difference was 9% greater than CBT, which is a 60% increased rate of full sustained remission over CBT that was attributable to 12-step facilitation. That's a big difference. If we were talking about cancer, we would be prescribing that all the time because it can produce much higher rates of full sustained remission. At the three-year follow-up, there was, again, a difference in favor of 12-step facilitation in terms of producing continuous abstinence. 50% more patients were completely abstinent in the past 90 days at 3 years in 12-step facilitation than in CBT and MET. Again, this was surprising to a lot of people. Now, why is that? Well, when they did analysis, and this has been replicated now in several other randomized controlled trials since in the last 15 years, what they find is that the mechanism, the purported mechanism, of course, is, in theory, is the idea of 12-step facilitation is you get people to go to meetings. You try and get them to go, you try to get them to get involved, get a sponsor, work the steps, get into service, and all of those kinds of things. And what they found was that that was actually true, is that when they looked at the mechanism, why did 12-step facilitation produce better outcomes when there were better outcomes to investigate? They found that the reason why was because people actually did go to meetings and get involved in AA. Since then, as I mentioned, there have been several other randomized controlled trials which have shown a benefit. What we see roughly on average is about a 10 to 20% benefit of 12-step facilitation treatments relative to other conditions like CBT. The reason why, and this was a complaint I heard from a psychologist in the room when I was, I forget what conference it was I was at, but there was the three-year outcomes were being explained, and there was a big difference at 3 years on one of the matching variables in this particular study. And there was a person who was a strong believer in cognitive behavioral therapy, which is a very good therapy, were saying, well, it's not fair because 12-step facilitation has AA, and we don't have an AA for CBT. So I was kind of scratching my head at that point, thinking, well, I think that's the point, isn't it? I really think that's the point here. That connecting people with peers who are in recovery and have the lived experience of recovery, the true, tried, tested ways through the school of hard knocks in trial and error, and that distillation of experience which is captured and disseminated and passed on in Alcoholics Anonymous. There are millions of years of sober experience, literally millions of years of sober experience, that are passed on from person to person. What we've found in the last 10 years is the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism have appropriated funding to study the mechanisms of behavior change. And so a question has been, well, how does AA actually confer the benefit that it does? And so, of course, there is AA's own theory about a spiritual awakening that occurs as a result of working through this 12-step program. And spirituality has been looked at as a mechanism of behavior change. But there have been many other mechanisms which have been looked at, because AA also is a fellowship, right? It's a social organization where people get together and they share experience, strength, and hope with each other to confer and exchange this powerful message of recovery experience. So what we have looked at also is how AA may change people's social networks. Okay, how does it change people's social networks? And that's been looked at. Does it also work by boosting people's coping skills, people's ability to prevent relapse by boosting people's coping skills to cope with high-risk situations? These could be situations where people are experiencing depression or anger or frustration or anxiety, or it could be social risks in the environment, people, places, and things that people have to contend with on a daily basis. Is that one of the ways that, that AA works? Does it also work by helping improve psychological well-being, reducing depression, by reducing craving? These are the kinds of constructs that we often look at in treatment to understand how treatments work. And so myself and colleagues around the country have done lots of work, thanks to NIH funding, looking at these mechanisms of behavior change. And what we have found is that AA actually works by doing all of those things. Very powerfully, it changes people's social networks. It helps people, you all know this, of course, but we have to prove it and show it to get any... But one of the things it does is it helps people drop heavy drinkers from their social network and adopt abstaining people into their network. Duh. Okay. Okay. All right. Yeah. Get some funding for that, boy. Yeah. 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 Yes, we do. Yeah. Yeah. Got to show that. Two and two really does make four sometimes. And but interestingly, there's many other these psychological mechanisms in boosting coping skills, boosting confidence in people's ability to cope with high-risk situations. One of the other factors that we know that how AA works is through this continual remotivation. So it facilitates continuous reappraisal through the constant exposure of the bad times of the past. Through the testimony and sharing at meetings, the stories that are told, people's memories are kept fresh. Those memories which can be suppressed or decay naturally over time are kept healthily, adaptively alive, so that people can reappraise their current status even when times are tough. that those memories of the past and why people started on the journey to begin with are resurrected and maintained front and center. And that is one of the ways that AA also works, is it helps to re-motivate people over time, because we know this is one of the factors that people often forget about the misery that happened that brought them into treatment or started them on the journey of recovery. I'll end in a couple of minutes now, just to I can take some questions, but one of the other things that we've learned through very sophisticated analyses that we've done is looking at the mechanisms of behavior change, but looking at it across different characteristics of different people. So, for example, we have asked the question, does AA work in the same way for men and for women? Does it work in the same way for young people and older people? Does it work in the same way for people who have very severe alcohol addiction and those with less severe alcohol addiction? And we've looked at this in several different studies and several different analyses. And what we have found, some very interesting results, which mirrors actually a lot of the results that we're finding in psychotherapy research. What we found, for example, is that women benefit from AA differently than men. I don't have time to go into a lot of detail on this, but just to give you the punchline here, is that for women, a major way that AA helps women is through boosting their confidence in their ability to cope with negative affect without drinking. Okay? So this would be coping with depression, anxiety, and things like that. For men, it was much more to do with social risks. So for men, it seems to be that the way AA helps men stay sober and in recovery is by boosting their confidence and skill to cope with high-risk social situations. Very interesting. Now, another way of thinking about this is rather than thinking about that AA works differently for different people and with different characteristics, is that people use AA in different ways to address the kinds of needs that they have at that particular phase of their recovery. In other words, AA is broad enough and rich enough and has enough experience that it's able to cope with all kinds of needs that different people have. We found also differences with young people and older people, and also people with less severe dependence and more severe dependence. So it's interesting to see that that people use AA in different ways and can benefit in all kinds of different ways to help them to stay sober. It's just that individuals' needs are different and they change over time as well, because recovery is not a static thing. The risks early on in the first 3 months are different than they are 3 years later and 6 years later. So people use AA in different ways at different times. We've seen this also, it mirrors the way that psychotherapy works. We have theories about how psychotherapy transfers benefit, but it turns out that patients, when they're receiving therapy, they're actually selectively attending to the different facets that are being offered as part of the whole package of psychotherapy, which have the most relevance and salience to them at that particular time. AA seems to work in the same way. So maybe I'll just say one more thing before I maybe take some questions. The other important thing is that from a healthcare perspective is that AA is free apart from voluntary contributions. And it always amazes me is that I don't know any other organization in the world that just does not accept money. It's not looking for money. And, I mean, AA only wants coffee, right? I mean, and some donuts, right? So I'm not sure if they'll accept outside coffee contributions. I don't know. But I don't know if that's been tested yet or not. The will of AA to resist coffee beans if they're donated. I don't know. But it's become increasingly important under this. You know, we spend 1/6 of GDP on healthcare. We are Very inefficient in the United States regarding healthcare. We spend twice as much as any other industrialized country for only half the benefit. That's a four-fold difference in terms of efficiency. So whether you agree with the Affordable Care Act or not, there's a need to shift things up to try and create a more efficient healthcare system, because we don't have limitless resources to be able to spend on healthcare. We have a limited amount of resource. So one of the freebies, one of the bonuses we have in addiction is we have groups like Alcoholics Anonymous, which are 1.2 million people strong in the United States alone, that can support recovery in the community for free. And there have been studies that have looked at the healthcare cost offset of treatments that link patients, as I've alluded to with this 12-step facilitation, that link patients to AA in the community. And what we have found in the science field is that when treatments do that, when they link patients to AA, they have about one-third higher rates of continuous abstinence, and they save millions of dollars for the healthcare system because they reduce the reliance on professional services. So this is another very important, kind of lucky thing that we have when we have such a high burden of disease, disability, and premature mortality from alcohol in particular, because alcohol is the big feature on the landscape of addiction out there. We have 20 million alcohol addicts and about 3 million illicit drug addicts in the country. So it's the big factor in terms of disease burden. And so it becomes important to take advantage of the good, you know, the lucky thing that we've had in the last 80 years of AA that's still here, that we can actually link patients to these free community resources, help them, and also help the healthcare system as well in terms of reducing the burden of disease in the country that's attributable to alcohol. So with that, I want to thank you for having me and giving me the opportunity to come today. I think we're going to do questions at the end. So if you have questions, please hold your questions, and now we'll have the next speaker.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kelly. You can see there's a lot of interesting scientific work going into this now. And what's really interesting to me always is when science finally catches up to reality. The other part that was mentioned too, that Dr. Kelly mentioned, was the lowering of the burden on the healthcare system cost-wise. I think it would also be interesting to have a study done at some point to show that once people are sober, they actually pay more taxes. So with that, I'd like to now to welcome Dr. Pagano, who is the Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Case Western University in Cleveland.
I guess it's good afternoon. I'd like to just start off by saying how humble I feel right now to be standing up here. When I first began my journey in research, nowhere in my wildest dreams would I have anticipated I'd be standing up here and talking to you about what I've learned. And if I'm really honest, what I've learned is what you've taught me. What I've done is just figured out how can I contribute to this show here. And my contribution really has been to apply my analytic training, my skill set, my knowledge about statistics, and my knowledge about psychology, and bring the what works about AA into addiction medicine from the research angle. I've really tried my best to get AA on the map in terms of its scientific rigor. It is a modality that works. I've been blessed to find like-minded souls along the way who can help me in this fight, so to speak. John Kelly and I have collaborated since 2005. But it is hard to find scientists that will support what your point is. You know, it's sometimes feels like going to battle. So being among friends right now is a great thing. So I want to give you a little bit about my background. Somebody asked me yesterday, why do you study service? Well, let's see. My mom would always make my sisters and I at the table growing up, you know, have the question when we came to the table, how can I help? Instead of, we're having that for dinner again. So how can I help was always like pushed, you know, as the right question to be asking. How can I help? And then, you know, again, from my dad's contribution, anytime, you know, I wanted to have an argument understood, he would ask me to point to the evidence. So when I would go to him and say, I'd like an increase in my 10-cent weekly allowance, he would say, well, can you show me where you think you deserve a 10-cent, you know, an increase in your allowance? So again, from the ground up, I've been trained to quantify things. If I have a point, I have to have supporting evidence. So that's really been a gift in shaping my lens and my course here. Why study service? So when I was a doctoral student studying, you know, psychology, I noticed that service, you know, in the sort of literature and what's taught, you know, as in an undergraduate and graduate psychology courses, is that volunteering is very important. It's very important to volunteer to prevent the big bad disease of addiction. Volunteer, get your kids volunteering so you can prevent having all these addiction problems. And then, you know, there's another body of work from Eric Erickson that points to generativity, that generativity, as you get older in life, your levels of helping others increases. And I was kind of going, well, what about the middle part? Do we just not care about helping in that part? Is that just go away and not important? It was like, I don't get that. So, and part of, again, I've been blessed and cursed sometimes with a questioning brain. Why that? Why this? That doesn't make sense. And been fearless about going after something that doesn't make sense to me. When I was faculty at Brown University, I was teaching faculty, teaching stats to postdoctoral students, training fellows in the addiction alcohol and addiction training institute at Brown. So that's where I was talking stats at first to John Kelly, but I got exposed to addiction research and what people are studying currently as important things to, you know, take note of and, you know, emphasize as important for the outcomes we care about. I should also say, too, that I have my own sort of orientation to understanding the 12 steps, and I, you know, grew up with alcoholism. I have many loved ones with alcoholism, and I tend to love alcoholics. So, the big book and main main passages and how it works. I got exposed to that in, I'd say, when was my first time I was, like, curious about what is the 12-step program, 1990, and I was in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I have friends here today that knew me from those days in Cambridge, and again, it's just, I'm humbled. So, I'm back at Brown, and I'm, you know, teaching stats to a lot of bright people who are, you know, studying elements about what's going on here with addiction and alcoholism, and, you know, what are the things that work in treatments. So I noticed there was absolutely no discussion, nowhere on the map was anybody talking about helping others. It was all about, we have to give this to the patient. The patient needs these services. We have to feed the patient this. The patient knows nothing and has to, like, have, you know, almost like a blank slate. All that stuff has to be wiped away, and we have to get them, you know, inundated with the right kinds of coping skills and knowledge, education. They know nothing. And I was just like, well, wait a second. This is so starkly different from what I know and have seen work. That's odd. So, again, what was really odd, I mean, there wasn't mentioning of step work that much. It was just barren. It was medications. It was what kind of parts in the brain light up. I mean, it was just not anywhere about the practical, what I've seen as important to know about. So I submitted a grant award to, you know, study service. What is service? And 12-step theory backs it up, but we don't have any evidence that service really makes a difference. What do we mean by service? Here we go back to my quantitative, you know, I have to bound it with a tool to measure it. What do I mean by service? Is it picking up a piece of litter? Is it donating blood? What counts? What do we mean by service? And when you start to think about it, it's like, how do I know if I've done enough service? Where's the ticker? I mean, again, I've been blessed with both a fearless mind and a practical mind. You know, bound is for me. Tell me how to get the gold star. What's the threshold here? So, and digging into what we've had, you know, studied to date, there wasn't anything. It was very broad service. And I'm like, okay, well, it seems to me if, you know, service is a very important agent for us to, for people to, you know, get to be their better selves, we should know what to prescribe when somebody's showing up at the door. How do we measure their levels of the service that matter, and how do we prescribe the kinds of service that matter? You know, we have plenty of prescription pads for Prozac and such. If this thing works and gives kickback effects, we have to know how to prescribe it. I wanted it to be that practical. So, again, where do I go for pointers? I go to the literature, the rich literature of the 12-step program, AA. You guys have guided me on what matters. And, you know, it's daunting to try to pluck out what matters to some degree, because service, again, it's all over the map. It's carrying the message. It's, you know, having a service position. There are a myriad of ways to help others. And so many of these forms of service don't require any lengths of sobriety, don't require experience, training. So to me, I was like, oh, I want to measure this. So I got a grant to do it. I said, we need to have a tool to be able to measure this, so that when people show up at the door needing help, we can gauge the things that the activities that, you know, we know that they need to do. I like to use the image of obesity. and how exercises to obesity. You know, alcoholism is an illness. Being obese is also an illness. It's a condition. And getting active in service is to alcoholism the way exercise is to obesity. And I need to know how much are you exercising and what forms of exercise? If you're like, I don't know, lifting up a piece of paper, yeah, that's movement. I mean, again, getting practical. But, you know, what I have learned today is that if the role of the clinician, and John was giving a great overview of that, you know, a lot of what I think the role of our treatment efforts needs to be is to help people get active, help them, prompt them to the ways in which they can be uniquely useful based on having 10 minutes of sobriety. You've got 10 minutes of something to share. So I got a chemical dependency license counseling, this license, you know, because I wanted to know what are the, you know, things that counselors are being trained to do. Service is not on the map. So we've got a ways to go, you know, to bring the connecting dots, you know. I have to first show it empirically that this thing matters and how to measure it, and then how to, the connecting dots to how it can be implemented into our practice. We've got a ways to go. But, you know, you can't skip a step, as they say. So one of the things I wanted to do was give you an overview of what I've learned, because, yes, I've developed a tool that we can gauge the kinds of surfing, the service behaviors that matter, but I want you to know, have a broader picture of findings of, you know, what I see operating with this illness. Anything that I'm going to be talking about, you know, there's, if you want to put your paws on the publication, the hard evidence, you know, journal article, I would point you to my website. And it's a very catchy name, helpingotherslivesober.org. So all the research I've been able to do, because I've been gifted awards, again, I can't do any of this. I mean, it's I do have to have a salary of some degree. So, you know, but that, you know, with funding support, I've been able to go after the kinds of things that you guys already know about. But us research, the research world and clinicians, we need a little bit more education. So I've been told that the brain really can't hold more than like 3 main bullet points of takeaways. So I'm going to try to make you hone in on 3 bullet points for takeaway. All right, so the first 2 bullet points really point to what I would call parts of the problem of alcoholism. These are points that are like what is contributing to having alcoholism. I would never say that they are the only things that contribute. I'm just saying that these are, you know, really important veins to the illness. There's a warped lens. What do I mean by warped lens? There's a skewed perspective. I've heard that AA stands for attitude adjustment, which I like, because it gets right at the skewed perspective. There's an over, there's an extreme amount of self-absorption, egocentric thinking. Me, me, me. Again, it's not like me, 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 I'm all, I mean, it can be I'm all that, but it also can be expressed as, the obsessive worrying. It can look like extreme, like fixation with body parts. Anything where your lens is so focused on you and your life and how, you know, anything that, again, there's not much room for knowledge or room of what are other people doing and how are other people. If the lens is narrow, me, 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 like either, you know, I'm all that, but I'm also, you know, thinking I might as well just, you know, knock myself off. That's, you know, narrow living. It's a skewed perspective. It's way too much me. The other part is there's almost like a blind spot, and I would never say that this is something that's malicious, because once a blind spot's pointed out, alcoholics tend to like recognize, oh my gosh, I didn't realize that. And once some of that realization filters in, it makes a difference. You know, the kind of sociopaths don't respond like that. So I call this kind of like a blind spot. And the blind spot is the low awareness about others. And if you're so full of me, there's not much room for others. And, you know, there's that passage in the Big Book that really is a great way to, you know, describe it. It's like, you know, the tornado blowing through the lives of others. And then when stop drinking and everything's like smashed out around him or her, he's like, hey, ain't it grand? The wind stopped blowing. Everybody else is flat out. It's just like, what? How could you not see how your actions, like, you know, affected others? There's a blind spot. Now, once that blind spot's pointed out, my experience is that, you know, behavioral change is corrected. It's, which makes me wonder sometimes why, you know, there's not more alcoholics going to Al-Anon to get that lens, but. First things first, right? So the blind spot, the horse blinders, this kind of like low awareness of others, there's another component to it that I like to describe as, you know, difficulty stretching, role reversal. I don't know if you've ever had anyone who like can't touch their toes, but it's like really a stretch to like really doing the splits is impossible. So taking the perspective of another person is like doing the splits, the alcoholic trying to do the splits. It's like, being all thumbs. It's really, it's foreign. It's not a comfort zone at all. And it's not like, again, it's malicious, but it's like writing with your left hand, taking on another's perspective, standing in another person's shoes. How would you imagine feeling if you were in that person's shoes? It's like an awkwardness. Very hard to tease out, though, again, if you're trying to figure out what's going on here. But again, I this warped lens, too much me, very little you. The second part of the problem and is this what I have coined a misfit syndrome. The, nobody else has studied or looked at it like in the research as misfit, but it seems to be what's the most common description leading up to finding alcohol. You know, I felt like I didn't fit in. I'm different somehow. I don't get it. Everybody else seems to have the instructions manual. I don't fit in. What's going on? And so, you know, the first part of the problem here with the warped lens is only a problem if there's, you know, pain. And the pain comes from this misfit syndrome. You know, if there wasn't any care about wanting to connect with others, then having a warped lens works just fine, thank you. It's all about me and very little you. See you later. Right? It's the pain of needing and wanting to connect with others. And, you know, this pervasive loneliness is there as part of what I would coin the misfit syndrome. Pervasive loneliness. Not comfortable in my own skin. Restlessness. You know, I've learned that 10 years of sobriety, the alcoholic wakes up with that irritable, restless discontent. That's like a steady state going on. And like the sort of condition, say, of diabetes, you have a daily routine you need to practice for remission, a daily reprieve of the illness. And this irritable, restless, discontent, I don't fit in thing is lurking around there when you wake up. So luckily, you know, a solution, a natural solution, you know, that can offset this, you know, misfit, underlying, restlessness, not comfortable in my skin thing, was figured out by Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson. And that's, you know, you get out of yourself by helping others. And so, again, part of my grant award was that, well, is it helping anyone? Is it helping Grandma Lou? What is it? Is it just helping? I need to know what kinds of help. And from the work I've done, I've shown that the recipient, you get the best kickback effect in terms of length of sobriety when you're helping a fellow sufferer. Again, you guys knew this already. It's about educating everybody else that's, you know, little, you know, coming into the scene cold. What I learned about, you know, well, what kind of help is it, you know, returning a phone call to a fellow sufferer? What is the forms of service to the suffering alcoholic that give the most salient kickback effect? And from the data, I can point to real strong ones, but they're all programmatic forms of service, meaning service position, scrubbing tables, as, you know, one of the speakers, had shared at the prior session. Used to be cleaning ashtrays, but we don't have that problem anymore. But again, you get it, service position. But I would say the biggest one that I would say if I had to tell someone what to spend their time on is to take another through the steps. With the knowledge that the person has, take another through the steps. Now, obviously, you can't teach what you don't know, right? So you better do some homework before you take another through the steps, at least, you know. I would have to say, again, my journey has been guided all along by a higher power. My grant award, when the government gave it to me, faced with a dilemma. My significant other's only job offer was in Akron, Ohio. I'm at Brown University. What am I going to do? Well, you know, again, I was able to move it. But what, you mean, talk about God wink. I mean, I land myself in the birthplace of AA to be studying service and what matters about service. I've been hammered over the head with what matters. But I have to say, I'm putting a plug in, you know, because I've been in program in Seattle, in Boston, in Chicago, because of my schooling and travels, you know, from where I've been and grown up and been privy to. Orange concentrate, you know, the cans of orange juice that are orange concentrate, that's what the program feels like in the Northeast Ohio region. Orange concentrate, and I mean, a watered down orange juice is still, you know, tasty, but if you really want to hear fundamentals of the program, spend some time in that region. It is orange concentrate. It is not distilled down, lofty dofty. It is like, again, a great place to study this, and I would have never planned that. So I also landed in a region where there is one of the, you know, the largest sort of, you know, I would say the national epidemic, but it's there's this huge spike in Northeast Ohio of heroin overdoses amongst young adults. So, again, I feel like I've been given a path to contribute where I can. And so I started to study what I learned with adults about service with adolescents, young adults. And I'm currently following the 100 girls, 100 boys with, you know, clearly have crossed the threshold and have the illness. There's no dabblers. They have alcoholism. And again, I think that having enough young women, to study this has been another thing that's been a gift, because this self-absorption, this warped lens of this me, too much me, it looks different among females. John was mentioned a little bit about it. There's some commonalities with cross-gender of what this self-absorption, this too much me, and entitlement is there. If I have to tell you what forms are the common ones, because, you know, in the big book, it's referred to as narcissism, it's referred to egocentric thinking. If you have all been in the psychology, you know, field, narcissism is a huge construct. What do we mean by narcissism? Vanity? I mean, it is huge. It's as big as trying to map out what is happiness. So, I don't know. The faucets of narcissism that are really tied to alcoholism has fascinated me. You know, because I hunkered down and figured out what's been studied thus far and how I can go about measuring it so I can study it and try to tease this out. I can tell you that entitlement is tied. Entitlement, you know, this, I deserve that. Now, trying to study this with young adults where we believe there's a natural, you know, developmental period of being entitled and all about me. So I've had to get creative about how to study this. And again, on my website, the empirical articles will show the kind of designs. But basically, I did what's called a match pair design. And I matched every youth in my study to a normative youth living in the region who doesn't have addiction, or I mean alcoholism, no prior use. You can't randomly assign somebody to then go on and get alcoholism. I don't know how many people would sign up for that. So again, I know the twists. I know how to isolate out the parts that, you know, somebody can come go, oh, you can't claim that because of X, Y, Z of your design. I know how to go about the robust design to study, to isolate out what's going on here. And again, that's been part of my, you know, contribution, my gift to, you know, this magnificent movement. All right, so I do want to say that I've also learned that being sexually abused is like a lever that it's a lever that pronounces more this warped lens. It makes it even more extreme than me, 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 and little you. It's like a lever. It plays out in its expression a little different by gender. There's higher exhibitionism with females, and there's more exploitation amongst males with a sexual abuse lever. So, I mean, again, that's been part of my journey to try to figure out this puzzle here. But let me get you to the third nugget to take away. We've talked about, you know, the warp lens, the misfit syndrome. I want to talk about what's part of the solution. Let's stop talking about the problem. So, getting active in service. Have I said that before? Well, I want to quantify some things to take away. It cuts your the risk of relapse in half and your risk of going to jail. How's that? Getting active while in treatment will cut the risk of relapse in half and going to jail in the year following treatment. This is with a sample of juveniles that are heavily involved with going to jail and crime. So it's not like, I had plenty to work with. Why does service seem to give this strong kickback effect? Well, I'm on to that. It generates a sense of belonging. Remember that misfit syndrome? It takes care of that. It's a natural platform to start to find yourself, to start up conversations, that social network changing your social friends, but it's the platform. I mean, it's easier to start saying hello and who are you and, getting to know people when you're working side by side with someone on, putting away chairs. It helps get you to show up every week at a meeting if you have a service position. It propels, it fans the motivation for staying sober in several ways, because I start to learn that I actually can do this. There's a building of confidence, and I want more of that. So it fans motivation for more feeling good. It also fans motivation because of that, the built-in forgetter. Because if, it's fresh in my face, what happens, what this disease can do when I'm helping a fellow sufferer. Again, it builds on a dark past to be useful to someone else. It does not say that all the strife you went through and pain is for nothing. You're a survivor. And alcohol was a creative solution that worked for a while. It took away that misfit. It took away that loneliness. It didn't do much for helping with the warped lens, but I'm back to not caring if I have a warped lens. Right? So alcohol, again, I see as a creative solution. And it makes sense that somebody's going to want to not have that taken away and buck if that's the solution for somehow life making sense and find, there's some joy. I have another, something else I'd like to go and see if it's true from the data side of things. I think that, there might be something where alcoholics don't get as much joy from, say, a sunset or a cup of coffee or these other things that other people find really like the reason for getting up in the morning and meaningful. But finding something that turns the black and white picture of your life to color in 3D. Oh, I get it now why life is worth living. We're studying the brain, I think, from a different angle right now in the science. We're studying it from, you saturated your neurons, you've depleted them, so they no longer get any reward benefit from all the substances. You've depleted your synaptic cell, connectors. But what if it's more like, the world became 3D and bright and, I get it's a good thing and a blessing to be human and born. I get it just, again, meaning and vitality. The hard thing is though, at a certain point a line is crossed and it's alcoholism now. And there's no more, there's no more lights turning on magic. And so at that point, we need a solution. And again, part of the solution is getting active in service. I would never say it's the only thing. I'm currently publishing an article that's showing for the first time effects from love and service. What I mean by love, but you know, Dr. Bob had said this program can be boiled down to two essential things, love and service. So, you know, love, as I measured it, is, you know, this conscious contact with a God, a divine God love. And believe me, that's hard to measure. Luckily, again, I stand on the shoulders of giants, and Lynn Underwood's tool has been helpful for me to gauge this. But you know that phrase, faith without works is dead? If you're high on this, you know, God consciousness, as you rate it, the scale, but you are low in service, there's no benefit, there's no improvement. So I'm going to be able to show for the first time, faith without works is dead. Again, I didn't come. You guys have given me what to go after. I'm just putting the empiricism to it. Hopefully, I can make a difference for, you know. But there are many ways to be useful, and we'll see about, you know. Sometimes it's harder to convince those who grant the funding that this matters, and you know, that's one of those things that you just keep fighting the good fight. I think that I want to, you know, again conclude with, I want to just say part of the getting active in service, it helps generate I belong, so that misfit thing goes into the background. It helps with motivation, keeps you propelling on this path. It gets you humble. It right-sizes that overinflationist self. It's a natural corrector for that. I showed empirically for the first time that, you know, after getting engaged in service, 6 months later, depression lowers below thresholds. So again, it treats depression. That's important. You know, on the clinician side of things, we worry that, oh, we don't want to get the people who are really depressed push service because they're fragile. Well, guess who's more likely to start helping during treatment? The data shows it's those who are depressed. And then 6 months later, if you interview them, this is all from the glories of Project Match data, by the way. but again, your depression will go below threshold 6 months following starting to help. That's important. That's pretty cool. It increased your interest in others. I have a funny story. I was talking about this result to another person in this fellowship, and he said, you know that promise about, you know, we'll become interested in others? Who wants that? You know, like, oh, God, I have to care about people? That's just going to set me up for more pain. I thought that was a really funny, you know, who wants that? But it's part of what makes life 3D and full of color. You don't get that without the interest in others. So again, I'll end with the clinicians in the room, those who are, you know, on the front lines. I think we're doing a disservice if we have this short window of time where people are willing to look at their behavior. If we don't get them active and lay out, here are the things only you can do that, you know, no professional, you know, is eligible for. Your experience makes you uniquely useful. So what minutes you got, that's going to be useful. And facilitating that, pushing that, and being clear that, you know, You're in the driver's seat. This is your life. You get to do your life. And who is the person you want to be? You know, I have just met, I mean, both, you know, in research and the professional side, but I have to say, the beautiful people I have met, I would have never crossed paths with people that had I not had this interest in calling. Beautiful people, like the all walks of life. And, oh, here's another good finding. I showed that you don't have to have a strong faith or believe in God or anything to, you know, start to benefit from AA. Now, again, we know that, and that's another thing. But, like, on the clinician side, it's, you know, this AA is pushed if a person indicates they're spiritual. Really? A lot of alcoholics I meet, the Muslims I meet, like, had a defiance towards God. Like, oh, I don't want any God business. If we turn, you know, don't encourage AA for those people, we're, you know, those people aren't going to get to know that the program doesn't require you to believe anything. It's based on your own experience. Your experience. Just try this out and see. You can always go back. So, exercise to obesity services to alcoholism. And it is what distinguishes AA from the other 12-step programs. That's another thing that I've noticed. Nowhere on the map is narcissism talked about in other 12-step literatures. This is a root that's, you know, part of the illness. It distinguishes itself, as you know, from the other 12-step programs, which lines up with, you know, the keeping it to alcohol primary purpose. But this, narcissism makes it just way too broad. It's like this warped lens. It's an extreme self-absorption. Too much me, not enough you. And am I, you know, worried that, oh, they'll, by getting active in service, you'll become flat out? No, I worry that more for clinicians. Clinicians can, you know, get worked too much. But let's try to get the you know, that huge skew, too much meat, just a little bit more here before we can worry about, you know, they're too fragile or are going to overextend themselves. Just a little bit more to center. I do have all the cut points for what's enough service, all that kind of stuff you can read off my website. But, you know, this program and the forms of service rise to meet you where you are. There's a something you can do that meets you where you are in your sobriety. And it matters with a week of sobriety. I showed it matters as is rated as important if you've got 1 year sober. It matters with 10 years, and it matters with 20 years. That's from data. So I hope I've been able to carry the message.